Hello and welcome to the Interfish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, Editor-in-Chief, joined by John Fiorillo, Executive Editor. So we've got just a couple of stories to talk about today, and unfortunately one is a sad one. We just got news earlier this morning that longtime National Fisheries Institute President John Connolly passed away at the age of 61. Now, you know, there are association heads that come and go across the world, across different associations. And some leave a mark, some don't leave a mark. And some take the job seriously, some don't take the job that seriously. But John Connolly was different. And he came to the National Fisheries Institute in an interesting period. And I think it's safe to say that John was one of, if not the most transformational leader in that organization. And I think he's had a profound impact on the North American seafood market and the global seafood market as well. But John, I'm going to toss it over to you first. You knew the National Fisheries Institute presidents before John. Knew that organization well. And so you are, you know, you're well placed to talk a bit about what things were like in the North American industry prior to John and what he brought to it.
Yeah, first of all, condolences to John's family. It's a great loss for sure. So prior to John joining in 2003, for the longest time, NFI was led by Lee Wettig, I'm trying to think back, my memory's a little fuzzy, but I think he was the original leader of the group, at the very least, the longtime leader of the group. He had, back then, he had the stature that John has had for the last 20 years. He was very respected, etc. He retired. Dick Gutting stepped into his role for a bit, and Dick was the legal counsel at the time, if I recall correctly, for NFI. And the group, after the void left by Lee, was pretty substantial. So the group was already struggling to kind of find where it wanted to go. It's like any organization at some point, you know, that you go through these periods where you have to decide where the organization really wants to go and what it wants to look like 10, 15 years down the road. That's kind of where they were. And members were staying, members were leaving. There was, you know, in the defense of anybody who's led NFI, it's a very fractured industry. They're trying to hold together, you know, the crab guys and the shrimp guys and salmon guys and importers and exporters and et cetera. So it's inherently a tough job to begin with. Anyways, in 2003, John walked in the door from the chemical industry. He was a professional association manager by then. He had come from a chemical association. So he wasn't a seafood guy, which, of course, immediately, you know, ding-dongs like me in the press, oh, he doesn't know seafood, you know, and okay, wrong. He didn't need to know seafood. He knew a lot more. He knew about people, and he knew about organizations. So I remember one of the first things he did was just kind of an internal study on what was broken about NFI, what needed to get corrected. And that laid out his blueprint, I think, for the next 20 years. And, you know, I'll argue with anybody, he executed it masterfully. And I know without a fact he leaves this industry and that organization in way better shape than when he got here. So that's kind of the background as best as I recall it. But John changed that industry at a time it needed changing, and it wasn't simple, but he did it with, you know, He wasn't like long arm of the law, strong man kind of that. He didn't take any of that approach. He just got people to collaborate, people to talk openly and honestly about the good, the bad, the ugly. And through that all, he distilled a way to bring them all together. And I mean, look at what we got now. We have, I don't know if it's a decade's worth, but it's close. A decade's worth of future leaders that were cultivated under his watch at NFI. And think about that. Think about these people have all gone through, training's not the right word, but have all gone through the NFI Future Leaders Program. And they will be the leaders of this, and are already the leaders of this industry going forward. What a legacy to leave behind.
I think one of the biggest legacies that John left was how the seafood changed its relationship with the NGO and sustainable seafood movement, if we can call it that. At the time when John joined NFI, you know, the seafood industry, you'll recall, John, and I, of course, recall, the seafood industry was still very much at odds with the NGO community and with the notion of sustainable seafood. There were eye rolls about it. There was, generally a oppositional relationship, and that extended, you know, across the world. And I think that John, he joined the Marine Stewardship Council board. I can't recall what year he did that, but that to me was a pretty watershed moment in that there was a recognition that the seafood industry needed to have a seat at the table on the Marine Stewardship Council and certification bodies. And I think that John's ability to demonstrate that he was advocating for the industry while at the same time embracing the concept, the movement of a movement towards sustainable seafood, he saw that coming, and I think he knew it wasn't going to go away. He by all means continued to defend the industry if he felt like the industry was being unfairly criticized. But he, I would say that the attitude among the seafood industry about sustainability changed a lot because of John.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, John was one of those guys who you could come in all on fire about something. Oh, the greenies, blah, blah, blah. And you could sit with John for about 10 minutes and have a completely different perspective, not because he was trying to change your mind, but that he broadened your mind. He would listen to what you had to say, and then he would expand the entire thought universe for you. And people who do that show you where your arguments or your feelings may not be fully fleshed out, or may fall short. And when that happens, smart people tend to back up a second, rethink their ways. But John just had a way of doing that without, there was no voice raising or arguing or any of that nonsense. It was just like, well, let's think this through a little bit, right? Let's think this through. And, he did the same thing with the whole health message. You know, a lot of it is fighting these old saws about mercury and poisoning, and certainly NFI defends the industry when those things pop up. But John went in a little different direction. While defending, he also said, well, we know seafood's the biggest thing about seafood. It's the healthiest protein on the planet, bar none. Bar none. So why don't we start telling people that? But why don't we do it with professionals that they listen to? Doctors, dietitians. And that whole program that has built up there, not, with the NFI staff too. He's got great staff. His staff stays. That's another great sign of a wonderful leader to me. his staff has stayed for the most part for a long, long time. So they built this whole health, you know, kind of message up. Today, it's the Seafood Nutrition Partnership, you know, which is basically carrying on that initiative and doing a great job at it. So yeah, he just saw things before others, or saw clearer than others. It's a talent for sure.
Yeah, and you know, another thing, just from a journalist perspective too, interviewing John and taking calls from John, on and off the record, you know, John was he was always honest about giving a clear-eyed picture of the situation. I never felt that John was trying to steer my work. Or steer how we approached coverage of something. He was very, very aware that we were going to criticize the industry, that we were not going to pull any punches. And I think he saw the value in having a news outlet like that, that wasn't just rah-rah, the industry is doing so great, but actually bringing a critical eye and pointing out issues that needed to be addressed. And there were a lot of times that, you know, I would get a call on my cell phone after a story or a commentary or something that we had written about. And John would sometimes just call to say, hey, that was a great piece, even if it was critical about the industry. And then he would kind of expound on it a bit and say, hey, these are some other angles on it that, you know, really are causing problems in the industry. And so he was always direct, always honest, open. And then my favorite thing too was he had a great sense of humor. He knew what our role as the press was. And he loved giving us a hard time about our coverage, you know, or highlighting when stories were important to the industry. And I always appreciated that, because I never felt that John was upset about negative coverage or coverage that wasn't flattering to the industry. I think he really realized the value of a free and open press. But I think he really, when he did see that there were inaccuracies in the mainstream press, you know, he came out and was, you know, very, very direct about that. And I imagine that when some of these reporters contacted him from the New York Times or Washington Post or The Guardian, I imagine that it was they expected something else than they probably got from John.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he was calm. He was rational, you know. Whenever a reporter calls and that's what they receive on the other side, it opens them up to listening more, you know, rather than just calling for a quote or whatever it be. There's two great stories we have to share, Drew, related to John. Was way back in 2006, I think we started the Intrafish Person of the Year Award, and John was our very first. And back then, we gave a donation to the charity of the winner's choosing. And we also, this was my idea, we also, using their face, created a superhero doll, a doll of the winner that we gave to them with a trophy that we all also presented. So we did. We gave John was the first one, and we got his picture, and that you could send it to this place, and they'd, you know, make a doll in a suit, in this case, with John's face kind of as close as they could on the doll. And, you know, they're 8 inches tall. They're like those G.I. Joes and those types of things. Anyways, sent it to John and, you know, sent him the award. And that was that. And I don't know, Drew, it must have been, I want to say it was 5 or 6 years ago. We were just shooting the breeze with John in the hall at God knows what event. And that came up somehow. And John told this story of how that doll has been incorporated into their family Christmas. They bring it out. I'm so fuzzy with the details. Maybe you're gonna get better ones than me, Drew. But I recall him saying they bring it out and they decorate it with, you know, kind of Christmas stuff, and they just laugh. It just brings them laugh. I hope they've been doing it, and I kind of hope they'll continue to do it if that's the case. But it was a really funny story, and that's just John. He always had some joke like that. But Drew, the other one I'm thinking of is the lobster press, the lobster press story. Can you relate that one?
I do remember, and it was a relative who I believe is on the NFI staff now. So he was given the award, and for all the other Person of the Year recipients who feel like they were shortchanged by not getting an action figure, we chose that because of John's sense of humor. So don't feel bad, and we're not going to go rush out and get one. That was a special one for John. We also took John out in Brussels to a restaurant, he was fantastic. He brought his son and his nephew, and his, I believe it was his nephew, and John was a little sheepish about this, but I think his nephew was reading right to left on the menu and decided he wanted to get a lobster dish that used a lobster press. And if you haven't ever seen a lobster press, that's not surprising because they are not that common. But essentially you get a fresh lobster and then you have this gigantic machine that you spin down with a screw and it presses the lobster and gets all the juices and pours it out in one angle. I mean, it's a very, it's an amazing thing to see, but John got the biggest kick out of that. And, again, was just kind of looking at us like, are you sure this is okay to have this, 13-year-old buying this ridiculously expensive lobster dinner? So yeah, anyway, that did hurt our pocketbooks, but we got a great laugh. So I think that kind of, those types of things, I think sum up John. He always, his lovely wife was always with him at events. He really, he just took the job, I think, as he was. I think what you saw was what you got with John, and I think that's an admirable quality in anyone. But I think most of all, I really appreciated John's sense of humor, and there was never a time when I talked to John that there wasn't laughs shared, and it was always a pleasure to be interviewing, talking, and just relaxing with John. So he will be sorely, sorely missed. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of memorial mails. There's already a lot of statements coming in, but this is all very, very fresh. And gonna miss John Connolly.
Amen to that.
Big news last week. The Washington State Department of Natural Resources, and indeed the entire state of Washington, banned finfish net pen farming in state waters. It was just hard on the heels of the rejection of trout farming licenses that were being renewals that were being sought by Cook Aquaculture, the Canadian seafood company. And it has really been interesting to track. There's been so many developments. We were so busy on all of last week, but especially on Friday, trying to keep up with the news and trying to track it as best we could as it was racing across from people's mouths to our pages. Now, at the center of all this was Hillary Franz. She's the commissioner of the Washington Department of Natural Resources. And when the Cook licenses were rejected, Franz sent out a press release at the same time celebrating the rejection of the licenses and teasing a little bit that there would be a big announcement on NetPen aquaculture in the state on Friday, which subsequently turned out to be the ban. You know, John, this has been an interesting saga for years and years and years. In 2017, one of Cook's farms suffered a collapse. I believe it was something like 300,000 fish escaped. I could be, correct me if I'm wrong there, John.
263.
Sorry, 263. And you could say that I think at that point it was probably a matter of time before Cook was pushed out of the state. I don't think that any of the groups that were critical of that ever really stopped pushing against it. And even though non-native salmonid farming was banned, Cook shifted over to steelhead, ocean-going rainbow trout, and that appeared to be going ahead. It was permitted, and the process seemed to be moving relatively smoothly. But I don't think there were ever. I think there was always intentions that this would happen from some parties in the NGO community and possibly in the government as well. But it's been quite a process. John, tell us a little bit about just the coverage last week. You were right there in the middle of all of it. There was so much in the run-up to it. Maybe talk a little bit about how Cook and the Jamestown tribe, it's a indigenous group here in Washington State, the project they were working on and how this is really just kind of come as a big surprise to them and just all the different angles here.
Yeah, sure. I think it came as a big surprise to everybody. Certainly Cooks seem to get surprised by it. And there wasn't really much tipping of the hand as to what was going to happen until those leases, until it was announced those leases wouldn't be renewed. So that's for two farms that Cook has in Washington waters, and they were raising steelhead, which was allowed. The law was changed after the collapse, and steelhead could be raised because they're native. So all of a sudden, no, the leases aren't renewed. And then there's a sentence at the very end of that original press release that says Commissioner Franz will make a statement on the future of aquaculture on Friday. And so that was last Friday. So sure enough, Friday comes and boom, everything's banned. Okay. While those two leases for Cook were, not renewed, there is currently a permit in front of the state for a lease to build a steelhead farm in Port Angeles, which literally is like 10 miles from me, 5 miles from me. It was a site where there was a Cook farm when they bought the farms from Icicle, or when they bought Icicle. And the Cook took it down because it was older and needed a lot of work. So this new farm is proposed to replace that. It will be built with the latest technology and everything like that. So at this point, the permit application is still before the state. Hasn't been acted on. Really little to no communication between the Jamestown tribe, which is doing this in a joint venture with Cook, and the state. The state hasn't really communicated anything on it yet. So that seems dead in the water. But it's interesting because in her press announcement on Friday, Commissioner Franz was joined by another group of tribal leaders. So this issue one could argue has split the tribal factions within the state, perhaps. So we don't know where that's going to go at the moment. But I think one point that I found really disturbing, and we're still working on this, but during her press conference, Commissioner Franz made it a point to say she had talked to Cook and others about transitioning to land-based aquaculture within the state. She remarked how she's, you know, lords over all the lands and all the tide lands in the state, and there's lots more, you know, land that isn't tide lands that she can use for, or that people could use for salmon farming, land-based salmon farming. So that's what she said. And of course, I called Cook and I said, hey, she just said this in a press conference. Can you tell me a little bit about these conversations? And Joel Richardson, he's a spokesperson for Cook, been there a long time. He said they never happened. There was never a conversation. Let me see if I can read his quote here. Hillary Franz and DNR, that's Department of Natural Resources, have never had conversations with Cook about doing land-based finfish aquaculture development in Washington, he said. Hillary Franz's statement in her press conference about that are completely false. So my question is, did she intentionally mislead people during the press conference? The press conference was attended by plenty of journalists, local seafood press, et cetera, et cetera. So were they being misled? What is actually going on here? We're trying to get to the bottom of it. But yeah, it just the things just went sideways very quickly with this. You know, there's been rumors in the Seattle papers that Commissioner Franz is eyeing a run at the governorship in 2 years. So is this her attempt to start building constituencies that will propel her into the big chair? I have no idea. But nevertheless, things took a hard turn. And unless there's a lawsuit or something like that, I don't think things are going to change. And the really sad part that, and you'll hear this from the aquaculture community, is there's a ton of science that it was before her on the safety of aquaculture in the state, the way it's, you know, set up now with steelhead, et cetera, and just apparently ignored it all. Just didn't take, or maybe took it into account, didn't care, didn't find it convincing. But it's from NOAA, it's from her Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's legit science. In other words, not a bunch of hocus pocus old saws that, you know, somebody's bringing up. So yeah, you decide for yourself what might be going on here.
Well, yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on this as we kind of go about covering it. And I think, you know, it goes to our conversation, John, about the U.S. aquaculture industry or lack thereof. And, you know, this is one more example of how aquaculture development in the United States is really, really moving slowly for a range of reasons, but one of them is interests against aquaculture. Interestingly enough, there was a bipartisan group of lawmakers that went out to see the Jamestown Scallum site, and I believe they went to one of Cook's farms. And they came back, and remember, bipartisan, that's rare in any government. And they wrote a letter to Franz saying, hey, and the quote was, these are not your grandfather's fish farms. And so there was this almost immediate awareness that that the perception of aquaculture and salmonid or net pen aquaculture it can change radically as soon as you get out to see the farms. Now, you may still oppose them. And certainly, I think in BC, there are groups that have said, yeah, we know how they function. Groups that are in partnership or have been in partnership in some cases with salmon farming companies and said, yeah, they're aware how they work, but have said, not in this area, or, have just decided it's not right for their lands. But not having been onto a fish farm and made these decisions, I think is short-sighted, because I think it can actually change the way people think about what these operations do, what kind of jobs they provide to people. And so I think that's a little bit of a shame. I think there will always be, when there is opposition to development by whoever it is, but especially the seafood industry, when there's opposition, the argument is always from the seafood industry, or at least one of the arguments, is that it takes away coastal job opportunities. That's a pretty common reaction when there's a press release afterwards or you do an interview with them. And, so it's expected. It's expected. Businesses want to have fewer regulations and they want to grow. But, it's also true that a lot of these areas on the coast, these coastal jobs are simply not there. There used to be fishing and processing industries that were in these areas. They're no longer there. I think I took most issue with the idea, was with the celebration of this and the way that it was sort of pushed out to Washingtonians and to, to all of the public, because this didn't save a single fish, a single wild fish. This did not protect one fish. I really believe that, because the issues with wild salmon in the Pacific Northwest are not about farm salmon. They are about habitat. So is there a problem with wild salmon in the Pacific Northwest? Absolutely, because they have no place to spawn. And so you don't get to have it both ways. It's sort of a feel-good announcement that, we're getting rid of commercial finfish farming. There was no way it was going to expand anyway. I mean, maybe this Cook site, this partnership with the Skalum tribe, maybe that was going to go through, but probably not a whole lot more than that. And so the sort of the communication was, oh, hey, now we've stopped this this industry that was coming in, taking over the waters. I mean, please, no. I think she also mentioned something about it impacting orcas as well and marine habitat. And, I think, again, it was used as a way to gain attention, as you said, John, to highlight this to a group of constituents. I think it's a shame, because I think there was a lot of information that probably some of these tribes that joined her didn't have. Because I think this idea that, we have a thriving commercial fishing industry in Washington State is a joke. You don't. You cannot have wild fish that isn't hatchery supplemented. By the way, I can walk, and probably most Washington residents can drive or walk not more than 5 miles, I would say, and find a hatchery, with the exception of people in eastern Washington. But even then, so most of the fish that swims out in the Puget Sound is from a hatchery, or it's supplemented with a hatchery, or it's somehow been mixed with hatchery populations. And there's just no wild salmon fishery to speak of here. Now, it has extreme cultural importance to the First Nations or the Native Americans in Washington State. Absolutely. And that should be really taken into account. However, what should also be taken into account is, what are the job opportunities going to be? So what will the state do than to help provide resources, provide jobs, provide provide income for some of these coastal residents and native tribes. And again, you don't just get to celebrate salmon farms being gone, move on, and say, well, that's taken care of. Now we've got our wild salmon sorted out. No, you don't. You really don't. And there, unless Seattle is going to tear down Amazon headquarters and somehow radically remake the entire economy so that all these people moving into Seattle and Vancouver, for that matter, unless they're going to change that and dig up the asphalt and concrete to have places for wild salmon to spawn, they're never going to be in the populations that they used to be, full stop.
Yeah, I mean, the argument that, you know, cutting out, well, in this case, two farms. Let's remember, this is two farms, this big industry she keeps talking about, that cutting these out is going to bring back wild salmon. I mean, please, that's a juvenile, disingenuous argument, and she knows it. I mean, she would have to know it, I hope. Yeah, and, you know, I go back long enough that in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a commercial salmon commercial fishery in Puget Sound. There was a fleet. There was a gillnet fleet. There was a troll fleet off the coast. They are a shadow of themselves if they still exist at all. Part of that is because of the Fraser River as well, because those salmon come down here and get caught as well. But nevertheless, there's no wild salmon fishery. And like you said, Drew, I mean, the idea that you're going to bring it back with what you just did on Friday is, I mean, it reaches new heights of ridiculousness, you know? So, but there you have it. And at this point, I don't know if there'll be a lawsuit by Cook or anybody else, and maybe there will. I don't know if that would change anything. But at this point, yeah, there literally is no salmon farming allowed in California, Oregon, Washington, or Alaska. So it takes out the West Coast. So there you go.
Well, I mean, you're seeing this a lot around the world. You're seeing opposition, coastal opposition, and government opposition to growth of salmon farming in particular. But you know, it does, again, it has a larger effect, I think, on coastal economies, on the perception of coastal economies. Again, I think the announcement and the way that it was celebrated really was, as you said, John, disingenuous. I mean, it was heralded as this huge step, and it really, really wasn't. It affected one company, really, financially, right? Of course, you could say the future of the Jamestown, Scallam, and Cook partnership that is also affected there. But look, Cook Aquaculture is going to survive. They just acquired an Australian salmon farmer, Tassal. Cook is going to be just fine. So let's not worry about Cook having too much of a financial impact here. But what it has done is it really has closed off a full avenue for a long, long time to come. And there are a lot of advancements that are happening in salmon farming, closed containment, semi-closed containment, all kinds of things. And that's just what we know now. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? But what we do know, what we are very aware of, is that commercial fishing, if anything, is going to continue to become less and less relevant, certainly in the Pacific Northwest. It's just a fact. And I would venture to guess And let's see how this all plays out. But I would venture to guess that there will next be a movement to remove hatcheries as well, because of the impact that hatchery-raised fish could have on wild populations. So, again, conservation, critically important. First Nations, Native American rights, critically important. But there is a element here of jobs and self-determination and coastal economies that I think it's a nice moment for friends, and it's a nice moment for some of the NGOs that have really been pushing against these farms. But then the dust settles and you have a decision like this made, and you're left with I'm not sure what. I don't know what the next step is for these economies. Tourism is often touted. That's silly to me. And I don't think that's a coastal job that in general a lot of people, some people want to be involved in. But, you know, people in the coast want to work. They want to work on the ocean. They want to work with a lot of, you know, seafood. We want to actually be connected with the place that they live. And for better or for worse, salmon farming and aquaculture is a modern way to do that. But you know, I think as you said, John, I don't see anything changing here. Now, we did sort of call privately. We were kind of back and forth speculating what would happen on Friday. And we kind of guessed, okay, something about land-based farming will be mentioned here, because this is obviously, there has been some work in looking at what's going on in BC. You know, I think several of the groups, the Wild Fish Conservancy was there with the announcement and obviously played an important role and would be very aware of what's happening in BC and other areas. But, you know, the fact that land-based salmon farming was brought up, it's not a surprise. We'll figure out why she said what she did. I mean, said what she said. I mean, politicians say a lot of things, and, you know, also kind of in the heat of the moment, you can try to spin things in a slightly more positive way. You know, and land-based salmon farming, that's years away from being a valid or relevant business in any kind of scale. So, yeah, a very, very strange week, a strange decision to me, in how it was rolled out and how it was presented. And, you know, I'm very it was good to see the different tribal reactions to it, and it seemed that there was a very, very positive reception to it. At the same time, okay, what's next? So I really do hope that Commissioner Franz and the Wild Fish Conservancy and other NGO groups that have pushed for net pen finfish aquaculture to be banned has some good ideas about how to create coastal jobs and support the economies of these different Native American tribes. I haven't heard those ideas yet.
Yeah, well, don't hold your breath.
John, we better wrap it up because we've got work to do, and all of these things we're talking about need to be explored in our reporting. So thanks, everyone, for joining us. Remember that you can find us on intrafish.com. You can sign up for newsletters there. You can go to the App Store and download the Intrafish app or Google Play, and that's the best way to keep up with our news, as well as if you are a subscriber, you can sign up for Keyword Alerts, which gets you an announcement on companies you want to follow, species you want to follow as soon as we publish news. So if you had alerts for Cook Aquaculture, you got a lot of news first before anybody else did last week. So thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you next time.